Hello, thank you for joining me. This is Ernestine Lyons, host of Quick to Politic, the podcast, the social commentary show that explores topics ranging from social justice to history, economics, small business, and of course, local and national politics. Thank you for joining me. Okay, just one second.
What did you actually go to school for?
I went to school for international relations. And then I also did a master's in political science, which at Wayne State is very public policy oriented.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the same people who take public policy, you know, are in the same classes as the master's degree for international relations. So honestly, they're the same degree.
Yeah.
But I loved theater. So that's I think that's where some of the theatrics and the news reporter like, let's investigate that kind of comes in. Okay, now we should be live.
Yeah, I'm seeing that on my end for sure.
Okay. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Quick to Politic, the social commentary show. I'm your host, Ernestine Lyons, and we are joined here by a wonderful guest, Keith Crispin, a friend of mine. And we're going to talk a little bit about nonprofits and entrepreneurship, which he is an expert of. And I am going to let you say a little hello, Keith, and all that, and wave to the people out there.
Okay. Well, good evening, everyone. Thanks for joining, Ernestine. Thanks for having me on Quick to Politic. As we were just talking about before, nothing brings me more gratification at this point in my career to be able to give as much out for free as possible. And platforms like this allow for me to do so and really connect to the people that need it most. So thank you. Appreciate that.
Awesome. Awesome. So I'm going to read a little bit about Keith's background so that you guys can know that he is a rock star out here. He holds a bachelor's degree in management from Wayne State University's Mike Ilitch School of Business and a master's in community economic development from the University of Detroit Mercy School of Architecture. I didn't know that. he also serves as the principal of the consulting group, the Crispin Consulting Group, or TCG. And his firm has connected startups and nonprofits to capital for nearly 10 years. TCG was chosen as the Small Business Administration's E200 Emerging Leaders in Small Business and Operational Excellence in 2013. He also believes that most organizations and people need to adhere to minor tweaks to reach their goals, which is which he's always excited to help folks with and to help positively impact their trajectories. He has connected startups to over $19 million since 2009 and has helped nonprofits connect to $6 million for community-based programming and place-based initiatives. All right, place-based initiatives. Now you're speaking my language. Okay, so welcome, welcome. Thank you so much for being here. Now, I think I want to delve into like the whole reason why I wanted to have this conversation, because Keith and I were both in a fellowship last year, the New Leaders Council, and I was forever picking his brain on, you know,
NLC.
NLC, shout out. and most of the folks from NLC I have interviewed on Quick to Politic from time
nice.
To time.
Nice.
You know, I just kind of wanted to talk a little bit about delving further into everybody around here kind of, you know, running around saying like, oh, well, I have a nonprofit and, you know, my nonprofit does this. And, you know, do this many people really actually have nonprofit organizations, or is it actually a business that is not making money or doesn't make revenue and it's just accepting right. donations? Because I know it's a lengthy process to actually get into that. So tell us more about what is a nonprofit.
Yeah. So specifically, what most people I think are maybe interested in is maybe nonprofits in general, but specifically 501c3s, which is when, because there are different designations of nonprofit organizations that the IRS treats it with a tax exempt status, but 501c3s are the kinds of organizations that folks are normally looking to start and or saying that they have or run when they talk about having a nonprofit. And 501c3 organizations, you know, there are a few steps that are required. I'll go over them briefly, but when you want to start a 501c3 organization, there are some basic things that mostly anybody can do. And then there are some things that I would advise you to, and by the way, my advice here on this platform won't be, is not to be treated as legal advice or financial advice, right? So let me say that out the gate on the recording. That said though, yeah, you know, there's some things that are simple. And there are some things that I would recommend, you know, if you're going to go after starting a nonprofit, you want to get some skilled help. And skilled help doesn't have to cost. There are some opportunities for folks to get free help from legal aid clinics. And, you know, some folks offer some in-kind services or pro bono. That said, though, you want to go to the IRS. You want to get your federal employer identification number, what most people refer to as a tax ID. You know, after you do that, you want to go to whatever state you operate in and register as a nonprofit. Let them know, hey, I'm here. I'm operating in the state. We are looking to get a nonprofit status from the government. And that's what's being said. The form you fill out, though, is just articles of incorporation for instance, state of Michigan, a Michigan nonprofit corporation. And then after that, you need to apply, right? You need to go back to the federal government, a different part of the federal government, and you need to apply for nonprofit status. There are two ways you can do it. There's a more lengthy way for larger nonprofits that expect to take in more than $50,000 per year for the first 3 years or the next 3 years of existence. And then there are nonprofits like probably the ones you and I would start that are smaller, that we don't necessarily see a pathway or any guarantee that we're going to see more than $50,000 in the next 3 years when our first 3 years of existence. Now, that's not saying we don't reserve the right to exceed that amount. But if we're answering honestly, we don't see a way. So you fill out that application, which is called 1023EZ. You wait for the IRS to get back to you. If they approve it, then boom, you've got a nonprofit. And then that's when the real work really begins. So if a lot of people are saying they've done that process, you know, some people have, some people haven't. Some people have done it, and then so much time has gone by that they may not even have the 501c3 status that they once had, maybe because they fell back or fell behind in their paperwork. So a lot of different, you know, scenarios, but to your question, do all these people actually have a nonprofit? It would probably take me or somebody who's skilled to kind of do some due diligence and check on it. But yeah, the process is easy in some ways, difficult in some others. I'm not trying to suggest that folks can't do it. I just think that the proper guidance and instruction would be probably the most valuable thing to you if it's your first time.
Thank you for that, because sometimes I wonder, like, you know, are you actually trying to run a, you know, a foundation as a person who's, you know, kind of like, oh, I want to do this? Or do you actually want to make revenue? Is that something that you're
looking absolutely.
To do, you know, and absolutely. What model might be the best for you? So that's really why I asked that question, because I really think that in some ways people don't necessarily have a lot of clarity around, you know, what they're seeking right. to do with forming organizations right. like this.
You know, I would say too, that's a great question/observation that you've made. I see the same. You know, I've been in this business for about 12 and a half years, going on 13. And to see the sheer number and the diversity of the kinds of organizations that still to this day, even have been around for 50 plus years, don't understand how valuable it is to run a nonprofit like a business. Because let's be clear, nonprofits are corporations, and corporations specifically. As a matter of fact, when you call the IRS, even if you have a nonprofit, when they ask you what kind of business is it, you know, is it a limited liability company or is it a corporation? If you say, well, it's a nonprofit, they're going to say that doesn't really mean anything to me. Is it a limited liability? Because you know what I mean? Like, so they want to know. And your answer, it has to be it's a corporation. I bring that point up because a lot of people forget that. And when you brought up a very important point, whether you meant to or not, I don't know. But when you asked about revenue, you know, that's so important because people hear the term nonprofit and they say, well, yeah, we're not supposed to make profits, or that's why nonprofits exist, because they don't. Well, profit is an accounting term. It's a legal term. You know, revenue, and what you alluded to is generating cash flow, you know, and generating that through your operating activities. And you most certainly not only want to do that, but have to do that and should do that if the goal is for your nonprofit to be sustainable, meaning you think it's going to be around or you want it to be around for a while so it can perform whatever work it is that you want it to perform. If you've targeted a certain community and you want to be specifically helpful to that community in the ways that maybe you've been able to see or research that they need the most help in, you want to be able to do that. So you want your organization to be around, and making money is so super important to that. To that fact. Also too, nonprofits tend to fall behind our for-profit counterparts, corporations and Fortune 500, if you will, because we don't keep that at the front of mind or as a forward focus. And then it prevents you from being able to hire top talent. People kind of already have an expectation. If you go work in a nonprofit space, you're going to make less money than you would if you were in the for-profit space. The reason that is because nonprofits haven't gotten that good at making money so they can afford to pay people and go to the Ivy League and promise them those competitive salaries, right? Which would obviously, right, gets more talent in the door. Not saying that automatically people who go to higher end or higher cost educational institutions are better. I'm not saying that. But what I am saying, though, is that they have certain exposure to things that maybe folks who don't get a chance to go to some of those institutions get exposed to, and they can bring those tidbits to the forefront so your grassroots people can only be amplified by that added perspective, right? You try not to have such a, so anyway, I bring all that up to say revenue is so super important, right? And diversifying that revenue, not just grant writing, but also coming up with ways to bring revenue in the doors that is harnessing the mastery of your organization. And I can give some examples as we kind of go along in conversation. But those are two very important things, is to distinguish between your restricted and your non-restricted revenue. And then also be very active in that space, harnessing the mastery of your organization to generate that kind of revenue to help you stay competitive.
Right, right. And you know, I'm actually glad that you brought up that point about like examples, because I remember you've been doing a lot of lives on social media, whether Instagram or Facebook, and I've been really enjoying, you know, you giving these tidbits of advice. And one particular episode, I guess, you kind of brought up, you know, advising nonprofits on the following. And one was selling skilled labor for volunteers for cash, to building programs around grant requirements. And then three, acting as a fiduciary to collect fees for nonprofits who are not as established. And I just kind of wanted to get into those a little bit more because I remember watching and then taking notes, but I'm like, I want to ask more questions on some of these things. So, you know, can you expand a little bit on these kind of examples, and would those be some of the things that you kind of wanted to use to illustrate the point you
made? Most certainly. First of all, the world is wide open in ways that you can generate revenue and come in the door. These examples I give aren't representative for anybody who's looking as like the main ways. These are just three that I really just came with off the top of my head. And I could probably come up with 20 more based on some of my experience. But in the interest of time, you know, I'll stay on point, on topic. And I'll say that, you know, based on those three, I'll go through the first one, right? Selling skilled labor. A lot of nonprofits do partnerships with folks who are skilled in certain areas that may even require a license or some added certification. So some nonprofits may have, for instance, partnerships with attorneys, partnerships with accountants. And because of that, they can offer their services either pro bono to that nonprofit as a partnership, as their service. Instead of writing a donation, they give up their time. Which is something else I want to come back to, giving up the time and why that's important. But also too, though, what happens is as they give that, well, then the nonprofit could turn around and say, well, we want to create an environment where folks in the community pay a reduced cost, but pay a cost nonetheless to get the kind of advice that would generally cost them way more. And because you're donating your service to us as the accountant, then the money that we take and for people to book you for an hour or a half hour or whatever, we're going to keep that also as a part of your donation. And now, and they're fine with that because now they even get a donation for that money as well, right? Like, so if you sell an accountant services for like $5,000 in total as a nonprofit, well, then that $5,000 donation goes in the accountant's name because they're giving it to, but you can do with that money whatever you want. So if you've got a printer that you've been wanting to replace for the last 6 years and your grant funding hasn't allowed for you to do so, for instance, boom, now you just amplify and increase your team's ability to produce, right, for whatever operational tasks require a printer. But the moral of the story is absolutely, you definitely want to harness the mastery of the people who you have these partnerships with, because as you identify needs in the communities that you serve and you harness their mastery, you do a few things. You generate revenue for yourself, but you also create a ton of data points, because as you qualify and pre-screen, if you will, the folks that will be gaining access to this expert, you're able to ask them so many questions that give you socioeconomic indicators for what direction you should be shaping your programming if you want to continue to serve this community. So it's the gift that keeps giving. Not only are you getting revenue in the door, but you also are able to do maybe a 3-question survey before and a 3-question survey after.
Right.
And then maybe you do that with 1,000 people over a calendar year, 250 a quarter. So 6 questions times 1,000 is 6,000 data points now you have that by far legitimizes any programming that you shape here moving forward, because now you have the gift of research on that. All you did was, I got to put you on do not disturb. I got a call, it just came in. But what winds up happening in that situation is now you got legitimacy that your peers don't, which brings me to my next point. You should stay competitive as a nonprofit. This whole, like, we're working together, we're all in this together. You are, you know, however, there's still some competitiveness that, not in terms of, you know, trying to beat them, but in terms of making sure you are at least matching their strengths and then overcoming their weaknesses, right? Not like you're Nike and Adidas. You're not trying to take market share per se, but you are at least trying to make sure that you are identifying who the benchmarks are in the space and then at least matching them to maintain legitimacy. And with these added data points, now that's the opportunity to exceed or overcome and make yourself a lot more competitive for funding from very kind of legitimate funders. The other two are very straightforward. Acting as a fiduciary and what was the other one? Building your programs around grant.
Around grant requirements, you know, because yeah, that's something that, like, wow, okay, well, yeah, these organizations exist for this purpose. Crazy? And that's a better way to align yourself with not only the opportunity to get more, but to also, you know, just kind of understand exactly what you're shooting for.
Well, and not only that, but you cut out the middleman, right? Like there's no situation. See, a lot of people write grants and then they still feel like, you know, well, there may be an eligibility issue, or we just may not meet the taste of the grant maker in terms of what kind of project we have, or at least line up with whatever their mission, vision, and values are from a funding standpoint. But when you design your programming around their criteria, you don't even have, that's completely removed from the equation. You never really have to be concerned with it. And that's just, you know, it's kind of like, that's why online dating has become so popular. It's not just because it's cool to clickety click, but it's also, I get to pre-screen. Ernestine, I get to see exactly what you want.
Exactly. Background, I need to get to see your age. There's no need to see, lie.
So
I get to
see we're the saving truth. All this exactly. time. We're saving so much. I mean, ideally, now I'm not trying to say it works that way. I don't know how it works. I'm not vouching for it. But what I will say is that, at least conceptually, is why it became so popular in the beginning and why maybe it even maintains that popularity. It's because it gives you opportunity to pre-screen and say, look, am I even worth
this person?
I can see whether or not it's even worth her time, let alone her seeing, right? Like, so, but then also too, like, right, it also helps me as well, because I can be more efficient in my search instead of just dating whoever, right? So same thing with the funding and the criteria. It's like, I'm going to at least build the pro, because what happens during that process is two things. Number one, you make yourself a shoe-in from an eligibility standpoint. That's not something you got to worry about. But the second thing that you wind up doing when you do that is, throughout the process of planning, you'll be able to see, like, oh, we can't do this. If that's the case, like, because you'll be building it, you'll be like, great. So this program requires that we have a board-certified psychologist to perform. And you're like, wait,
And you're just like, oh, well, this is where I need to grow because I don't have that. And so I think
now your continuous improvement plan, right? Your continuous improvement plan is born right out of that process. So you're killing like 2-3 birds with one stone. That's why I say it just baffles me how people like build a program and then go search for funding criteria that matches their program. It's like, wait, why do it that way? You save so much time if you just find some funders and build a program that's eligible for all of them. Right. So, I mean, that was that one. And then the last one, again, fiduciary. A lot of new nonprofits don't have their 501c3 status, but they're still registered as nonprofits in the state they operate, which means what? Which means that you can continue to go ahead and continue like your nonprofit activities in that state because you let them know we're here and we're still waiting. But when it comes to taking funding in, a grant maker is not going to fund you if you don't have your 501c3 tax exempt status 99% of the time. I'm just saying that because I'm sorry.
No. I mean, like, I feel like it's still baffling to me because I you can be listed as a nonprofit with the state here in Michigan. And then you don't have the official, you didn't file the paperwork with the federal government. So that means you could still go out and do fundraising. You can still go out and have this charitable mission. You're out here feeding the hungry. You're out here.
You can do fundraising, but if it reaches a certain amount and you have to have a fiduciary agreement in place, because the fiduciary agreement is an agreement with a nonprofit that has a 501c3 tax exempt status that is active. And then that fiduciary receives the money for you. And the reason the IRS normally requires that when it comes for tax purposes and funders have to adhere to that is because it maintains the paper trail. Because if remember now, when you go get a tax ID number, people just get excited about that because that's
the first step. I've done everything I need.
Right. And what you've really done is you've given the government now the ability to tax you. That's what a tax ID number. Just like a driver's license number. You couldn't have a driver's license number without a driver's license. You know what I mean? Like, so you need the license, which means now the government has a way to track you and write your tickets and so on and so forth, and suspend your license and register your cars and whatever. That's why you can't do a lot of stuff without a license. But we get excited when we get a license because, like, I'm 18, I got my driver's license. The world is my oyster now, and it is, but there also is a way to, the purpose of it is to track you. Same thing with the organization. So you got to make sure your paperwork is tight, because what winds up happening when you go to file your taxes, remember, you have to file your taxes with the federal government. You can't just file them with the state. And if you file your taxes with the federal government, but you don't have a tax exempt tax exempt status, then you're going to get taxed on that as income and not nonprofit. Like you're not tax exempt. So, but if you have a fiduciary, then you're not taxed because the fiduciary agreement and the nonprofit status with the state. It puts you in the clear, at least in the short term. So, anyway, fiduciaries do that for young nonprofits who don't have their 501c3 status.
And they take an administrative fee. Questions in the chat here, we have this, somebody asks, like, does the nonprofit has to be the fiduciary, or the third party has to be the fiduciary?
Right. So I'm not sure what they mean by third party, but let's be clear. If you have a funder, then you have a nonprofit organization that has a 501c3 tax exempt status. And then you have a nonprofit organization that basically is an aspiring nonprofit organization. They're registered in the state, but they don't have that treatment from the federal government. Then what winds up happening is the nonprofit that has 501c3 tax exempt status acts as the fiduciary to the nonprofit that does not have 501c3 tax exempt status. And then the funder pays the nonprofit with the 501c3 tax exempt status. And then they disperse the money to the other nonprofit based on that agreement. And they get to, they take an administrative fee, 2.5%, 3.5%, because they dole out that money and there's an administrative capacity that has to be allocated to that process. And that's why I mentioned it as a way to make money, because now if you're a nonprofit with a 501c3 status, you could take 10 nonprofits under your wing, because you can administer their grant funding and maybe even help them write grants. And for that, you could take a 2.5 to 5% administrative fee, and you're just making money off the grants that you're helping them get.
Okay, that makes sense. So now, okay, I'm getting comments here. And so the clarity here is, Alicia said, I thought we were discussing a partnership between a for-profit and a nonprofit. So that actually brings up another question. Yeah. Can that Okay, so that was the original question. Can a nonprofit partner with a for-profit organization and
Absolutely.
They get funded by a grant?
Well, let's be clear. Is the question asking, can the for-profit corporation get funding through a grant because of the partnership with the nonprofit? Or is it asking, as partners, can they both get funded for a grant? I'm just trying to understand.
I'm curious to know both, honestly.
Okay.
Is that like that kind of like, because I've heard of an LC3, which is a, you know, quasi nonprofit or kind of, you know, it's got different elements of like, you've got a profit element and you've got a, you know, charity element, but you're still, you know, maybe you create things and you sell products and then you're able to still, you know, have that as your business model.
Right. So a few different things in that. I'm going to try to keep it as short and kind of simplified as possible. The question about whether or not a corporation can partner with a nonprofit and then have whatever they're working on funded by a grant. Yes, it just needs to be worded in a way where the corporation, the project has to have certain nuanced aspects to it, meaning the nonprofit has to be the one actually doing the work. And then the for-profit needs to be assisting and supporting them in ways that increase the bandwidth and make their outcome, the impact outcomes, you know, more impactful, right? Like that has to be the nature. It can't be, well, the corporation is doing all the work and the nonprofit is just the front man and then get funding for a grant. That wouldn't work. That wouldn't be something that any funder would get behind. It's got to be the nonprofit actually doing the work and then the for-profit adding to their capacity and helping them do their work. Because in that case, the partnership with the for-profit actually makes the grant application stronger, right? So a lot of grant grant makers or funders, they like to see partnerships, not only with for-profits, but other nonprofits as well, that increase their ability and their bandwidth to do their work. It's kind of like more of a sure bet, right? If I'm gonna make a grant for $100,000 to feed, you know, 2,500 families in a 10 zip code geography, I feel very comfortable making that grant to a nonprofit that has partnerships with for-profits that help them distribute that food, have partnerships with nonprofits that help them with the manpower.
Oh man, he's froze.
Teamwork is going to be synergistic.
You back. Okay, good.
Here awesome. We go. Am I back?
It might have been me.
No, but I feel more comfortable as a grant. Yeah, I feel more comfortable as a grant maker because I feel like a synergistic outcome is a lot more probable, right? If you're just an organization alone. So that's the first point. The second point about if can a corporation get funded through a grant and have a nonprofit as a fiduciary? If the corporation itself doesn't have a nonprofit arm, no. If it does, yes. You know, and then at that point, it would just be two nonprofits working together because that for-profit has a nonprofit arm. And then we can kind of get into the weeds a little bit on this, but I can't stress this enough. And I'm not just saying this for a disclaimer either. I'm not giving legal advice. I'm not giving financial advice. So I got to be clear on that. But at the same time, I also want people to understand once you start getting into the details, the nuances, that's the point where you need to go get an expert and pay them for their expertise.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Right? Like, one of the people I'm taking a course right now, and the woman who instructs it, she says, you know, I put my money where my lack of knowledge is. And it's just like, you know, you want to pay for those services when you're like unsure and you need to figure out, or at least go and consult with experts. Yeah. Even if it's, I know there are a lot of legal clinics that, you know, offer free services. Wayne State offers services like that. So, right. And shameless plug because I'm
tons, a state tons. Alumni. The local legal in Detroit, we're blessed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But, yeah. So Wayne State, we're blessed in that way. We got Wayne State. We've got University of Detroit Mercy.
Yes.
We've got some law schools and some law clinics around where we're very fortunate in that way. So I would say take full advantage of that. Also the accounting aid, what is it? The Accounting Aid Society?
Accounting Aid Society.
Accounting Aid Society, they're able to help out when you start to really get into the weeds on tax treatment, make sure you're on the right side of the law. You know, I'm telling you, the two people that you never want to skimp on hiring are experts that can help you protect your business and experts that can help you grow your business. Those are the two you never want to skimp on. You can literally skimp on anyone else. You can go with the lowest plumber, the lowest electrician. I mean, obviously you want these people to be licensed, right? I'm not telling you to, you know, whatever. But I'm just saying, like, you can afford to kind of maybe haggle, sometimes bargain. But these professionals, these experts,
you want to invest in them.
You got it. It's an investment.
Especially because we're talking about entrepreneurship, small business development, and nonprofits. Like, because you're operating at this professional level, because obviously you've taken this leap and you've, you know, decided to go forward with this kind of a move. You might can skimp on, you know, hiring somebody for your social media or marketing, but you don't want to skimp on things like investing in somebody who's going to help you with your finances and keep you on track and, you know, help balance your books and things of that nature. So that kind of leads
me and also into... go ahead.
Finish that thought, because you were about to
I was just going to say too. I was just going to say the other piece to it, and I'll be brief though, is from a different perspective. Not only do you not want to skimp, but you also don't have to be competitive in a lot of those other places that for-profits have to be competitive in, right? Like, nonprofits don't have to have super competitive websites and super competitive social media and get all of the impressions and satisfy all the marketing do's and don'ts of du jour. Like, you don't have to really be competitive in those spaces because your work is impact driven, right? If you're a nonprofit and you're focused on feeding families, then your passion is in feeding families. It's not in your marketing. Is that saying don't invest in marketing at all? No, you absolutely want to frame your story. You absolutely want to be able to effectively communicate it to the folks that can connect to it best, right? So you certainly want to market.
Make sure you're telling people like what your organization, what impact they're having on whatever it is that you're seeking to push the needle forward.
Sure, sure. But you can also afford to, you know, shameless plug, hire a consultant, right? Because a lot of for-profits, they got to keep people on staff and support salaries. But a nonprofit can hire a consultant every couple of years to help with their branding, and they're set, and then just pay a few thousand, or you don't have to worry about paying, you know, a department of 10, an average salary of 75,000, that's 750,000 plus fringe. But, you know, the most nonprofits don't even have a fraction of that to pay in salary. So it pays dividends for them too, to just hire a consultant, a few thousand here, a few thousand there, get something done, and you're set for 2 years. Right. So just another
especially
point.
Especially if they're really good at what they do, then, you know, you're just going to get something that's going to stand the test of time, no matter what your strategic plan or 5-year plan is going to be for, you know, you can still integrate that into what you're doing. So that actually brings me right into more questions around entrepreneurship. So I wanted to ask about advice for entrepreneurs, but we also have a question in here. From the chat that specifically asks about advice for entrepreneurs, particularly for-profit businesses, when coping with COVID and being able to, you know, bounce back. And, you know, during the pandemic, if you maybe had a travel business or a business where you went into the classrooms and talked with kids about the importance of learning a foreign language, and you were just getting off the ground, and then you were thrown a loop. So how do you, you know, begin to, what advice do you have for like being able to pivot during the pandemic?
Yeah. So I always say I'm going to say two things to you, and then I'm going to give you an answer. The first thing is that nonprofits, they feel like a lot will be fixed if they get the money they focus outside the organization. Most needs to be handled inside the organization, and that'll actually fix their problems. With entrepreneurs, it goes even deeper. They think if they fix their business will be good. No, they've got to fix themselves. So it even gets more personal on the for-profit side. And when I say fix yourself, I'm not talking about like Anyala Von Sein fix my life type stuff. I'm not even qualified to have those conversations.
That can be good too when you're investing in your employees.
Well, but that's not my skill set. I'm not saying don't do it. Absolutely do it. I'm just saying I'm not a resident expert on that. Where I am a resident expert though, is that the shift of perspective, right? Which is what I'm really kind of getting at, and shifting your perspective. So those are two things I'll say about that, and then I'll answer your question. For entrepreneurs who are experiencing some obstacles when it comes to this new pandemic environment, this new normal that we're facing, I think the very first thing they have to remember is why they got in the business, or at least why they should have gotten the business. A lot of people get in the business because they got a great cookie recipe, or they can make made to measure clothing better than anybody else, or they've got, you know, whatever, right? Whatever technological breakthrough, robotic software, app-based, whatever, personality, style-based, pop culture, what have. But what it should have been about is looking at the marketplace, seeing what's missing that people would like more of, and then filling that gap.
There you go.
I've got a mantra in business, at least, you know, before we even start and have our conversations, it's see a need, fill a need. That's it. If there's a need, you fill it. Okay, that's your first order of business. Now, to stay competitive, you need to fill it better than other people. So whoever else is doing it, you got to fill it better than your peers. Okay, then your step three and your final step is you have to hone in on and be effective at whomever identifies themselves as your main consumers. You've got to get good at tapping into what they like in their taste as it evolves, because business is very simple. You figure out what people want and then you make it. And then you ask them what they'll pay for it, and then you sell it to them for that price. And then when they tell you your item's good, you keep making it that way. And if they tell you that it's not good, you change how you make it based on what they said. And then you ask them how much they'll pay for the new version, and then you charge them that. It's so easy, right? Like, you don't even really have to think that hard. It's more so being able to channel your talent. And I think that talent can be channeled in a variety of different ways, which is why I say your first order of business is to shift your perspective. If the need that you feel with your business now no longer exists or has significantly declined because of the virus, and you just can't really get people in the door or get sales as you once did, then I think one of the things you need to do, hopefully you've at least been good at, if you've already been in business, getting a good listserv of clients and folks that you've helped or took referrals from or dealt with in the past. And maybe that can be your starting point to start surveying people, whether formally or informally, and maybe even incentivizing if you have to, and start figuring out what new issues are people facing now. And then take that information and say, well, this is what I used to make for you, or this is what I used to do for you. But now I can actually transfer a lot of those skills, transfer a lot of those methodologies, transfer a lot of those materials used to now. I'll give you an example. There was a local sewing company in Royal Oak. I can't remember the name of them, but they would do a lot of different like merch orders. And then when the virus became a global pandemic, they halted all of their orders, returned money to their customers, and they devoted 100% of their bandwidth to making face masks.
Right. And that's a funny
thing. They quintupled their annual revenues in 4 months. They made what they would make in a year, 5 times over again in 4 months, because they saw a shift. And then they say, well, we've never made face masks before. That's not what our production is. And that's not why we started our company. But there's an obvious need for this, and we see where the direction is heading. And if we miss this, we'll probably always make money, but we won't make this much money if we don't shift, and we don't shift right now. And that takes vision. And they did that. And then the outcome was, you know, fivefold annually in a 4 month period, which is crazy. It's nuts to think about that, because now they can afford to do a lot of different research and development and right fit different aspects of their business to really kind of scale capacity for the future and really make tons and tons more money than they would be able to. So this will be an inflection point for them, is what I'm saying. And I think that's so super important, that I think people, what they're asking about is really an inflection point in the making. How are you going to shift to make more money than you've ever made before by providing more value to people that you've ever provided before? And I think that takes a perspective shift.
It's very right. You know, you have a good point about, you know, we heard stories back in March and April of last year about people who, you know, they were a distillery and they had to shut down. And so then they started making hand sanitizer. Exactly. Or, you know, they Ford started with shut down their car production and started with PPP.
Ventilators.
PPP, because I work in small business development.
Right. I know.
Payroll protection. But PPP. Yeah. And I think that's the thing. I'm really like this nerd when it comes to watching stories of small businesses that kind of started from a certain level and then they had to pivot. You'll hear stories time and time again about, you know, how Chick-fil-A started out doing one thing and then they started shifting to sell chicken sandwiches because they had this order, or, you know, other corporations like, you know, maybe a Sprint or a Verizon or Nintendo, you know, these companies that, you know, were doing one thing and it wasn't working. And instead of throwing in the towel, and I think that's kind of what we have to do, you know, as small businesses and, you know, entrepreneurs, to be able to pivot with the needs. You can't be Blockbuster and we're going to always make VHS tapes, or we're going to charge for rentals when, you know, you've got this new guy on the block, Netflix, who's, you know, sending
Blockbuster should have easily been Netflix. Exactly. I mean, any, and this is where I speak freely, Ernestine, any clown could have sat up there and said, people are going to stop putting VHSs and VCRs. Like at a certain point, we need to start thinking about how we're going to push this AV revolution forward, because we've been having a market corner for how long? Blockbuster and their impact on communities in terms of creating that service for people. I mean, generations they span, arguably. You know what I mean? So it's just interesting to see how, like you said, some companies that in their case seem stubborn, you know, and that becomes the very thing. And then the irony of all this is that Netflix has been talking about what a brick and mortar or vending machine or, you know, partnerships with other organizations. It's just funny how they may wind up having a location. It's kind of like full circle and ironic twist. But to that point, though, yeah, you know, you've got to be married to the pivot. Right. I mean, because once you stop changing and evolving, you start dying. Right? Yeah, one of my football coaches used to say, you never stay the same. You either get better or you get worse. Period. So when you're sitting on the couch, you're not doing push-ups when everybody else is running sprints and doing push-ups, they're gaining on you. So you're getting worse, right? So it's no static. You've always got to be in movement and constant evolution.
Thank you for that. No, it sounded like there was some sort of crazy thing going on outside. Transformers exploding because of cold weather or something. Oh, but you know, you touched on leadership. And this is something that I hosted a workshop this past Valentine's Day, investing in you, self-care. Nice. You gotta love yourself. Starting with your finances.
I saw it. That's what's up.
But we talked about the importance of good leadership, and you touched on this earlier. And you know, you see that innovative CEOs will take a company in a direction. And if that CEO leaves, or if that CEO becomes really stubborn and digs in their heels, then they're going to be actually the downfall of the company. So, you know, I think it's important also, you were touching on this earlier about being willing to innovate, being willing to, you know, just really, really, you know, roll with the punches. And, you know, that kind of shows that a company is honesty. Going to go places when they're doing that.
Yeah, you're right. And I think honesty is really what it boils down to, being able to be aware and honest with yourself. As a leader, I know where my strong points are. I tell people the second most valuable thing in business is to know what you don't know, right? That's so high on the list. It's number two. And the reason it's number two is because when you know what you don't know, then that also allows for you to go get that talent. I'm not a numbers guy, so I need a CFO. Right? I'm not a marketing girl, so I'm not a marketing lady or a marketing woman, so I'm going to go get, let me correct myself. I'm not a marketing woman, so let me go get you know, somebody who specializes in marketing, right? Or whatever, right? Even if you say, well, I'm not the person to lead the organization, I'm the person that likes to be in the trenches. Let me go get a CEO. Right, like that's, you have to have that awareness, and companies have that awareness. I use Tim Cook all the time. And so, you know, Steve Jobs was a visionary technologically when it came to hardware. Hardware, he was it. And then nuance and design, you know, he was down to the very smallest granule. He would make sure that everything was right. Tim Cook is a completely different guy. Is he tech savvy and is he intelligent in that space? I mean, without question. But he's more software and services, which is why, you know, God rest his soul, Tim Cook taking over for Steve Jobs. Now, Tim Cook, since he's taken over, we see more services and more software out of Apple than ever before. The phones have maybe shifted, but they mostly look the same as when Steve Jobs was here. Same display, same, you know, biometric security, still leading things, but the services have been. And I think that's an important point, is you bring your own signature as CEO. You don't have to be what the other person was to be great. You can be great in your own right. You have uniqueness to you in the market, and the global marketplace needs that, right? But you got to be honest with yourself too. And I think in leadership, once you know what you don't know, and people may be wondering, well, you said the second most important thing in business. Well, the first most important thing in business is to know what's going to happen before it happens. But very few of us get that option. Next best thing is to know what you don't know. I mean, because if we knew it was going to happen before it happened, then we wouldn't even need to know what we didn't know. We would just need to, you know, you got the crystal ball, you can make yourself rich in that way, but that's not realistic. So the second is that, you know, so being honest with yourself is really where that separates the companies that do well from the companies that don't long term, is because not only are they unafraid of evolution, but they're honest with themselves, you know, and then they can build a team that way, a team that's very synergistic and able to really kind of get ahead and bump the company ahead of the competitors.
Thank you. Thank you for that. And, you know, you answered a lot of the questions that, you know, I originally sent over to you when we first started talking about nonprofits. But I do want to pivot a little bit because the show is Quick to Politic. And, you know, I work in politics. And so I just really want to ask more folks like yourself who work with, you know, businesses, and what more can we do as policymakers to really advocate for the fact that the world has changed and there are more people who are more entrepreneurial? And, you know, how can we reflect the policy changes that we need to advocate and fight for, you know, entrepreneurs, small and mid-sized businesses, not these giant corporations, because that's one thing that the coronavirus writ large, the fact that there are inequities when it comes to, you know, small businesses actually getting the help they need, the mom and pops, you know, the ones that, you know, are owned by a local person who, you know, actually has bills. And, you know, it's not, you know, some corporation with, you know, over 500 employees. We're talking about you have 17 employees and, you know, you live in the city of Detroit and you work there with your own business. And so how can we change policy to reflect the fact that entrepreneurship is kind of maybe being put on the back burner? Because I, in 2020, I attended a lot of conferences before the pandemic kind of shut things down. And I noticed they were all about Michigan return to jobs and incentivizing, you know, big companies to come your way. And I think that even in Harper Woods, our focus for a very long time was we need another big box store to come in and fill the void that's been left in Eastland once businesses started leaving. And Eastland is the mall that's kind of like on a downturn. And a lot of the anchor stores have left. And so I don't think that's the answer anymore to attract a big box, to attract a big corporation. You have to invest in local. You have to grow your own. So what can we do as policymakers to really push for this and get this on the agenda, get this, you know, in front of, you know, state lawmakers and also in front of people in DC and get it on people's radar?
So I think the answer is probably one where we could probably create a series of 10 of these and then probably have an hour conversation each time. But I'll make an attempt though, and say a few things that I've realized and noticed in my time as a consultant. Number one, I think in the short term, I think that your city council and city councils that look to turnover positions to more youthful, more maybe creative in terms of non-traditional ways to solve issues. I think that voting those kinds of people and institutions getting behind those kind of people that run for public office, obviously kudos to yourself and kudos to Harper Woods City Council for placing that faith in you. I think that that is an institutional way that folks can tap into their strengths, right? Put money behind people, educate folks, groom folks. NLC obviously has some implication and not to really kind of plug them per se, but also obviously to plug them per se, because they do such a great job at preparing leadership, balanced leadership, which is important. So I think institutionally, that's a great place to start, is really kind of not really making it mandatory as much as being unafraid to renew the commitment to understanding the issues that communities are facing and not putting too much time and tenure into folks that have held positions for so long and maybe have not been able to get the kind of change to come that should have come or should at least have been paid very close and special attention to, you know? So I think that's the institutional way. But also I think that the governmental departments really need to embrace folks like, you know, myself and folks that are boots on the ground who have specialties and qualifications and a track record to kind of be the liaisons and the middlemen and middle women to connect the small businesses in the communities to the funding, because, you know, policy is not going to be written or structured every single time. It certainly something can be done to make it more simplified and easily understood. But at the same time, I think that the partnerships is where government tends to shine most when they partner with subject matter experts, again, as middlemen and middle women, to help bring folks, elevate the level of discourse in the community, help them understand these policies and the implications of them, these grant opportunities and these funding opportunities and these lending opportunities and these business growth and development opportunities to help people understand, because most of these, excuse me, don't really have the bandwidth to employ as many people as they truly need. And what winds up happening is they put people in these positions and spread them so thin that the impact that they designated as their goal to accomplish, you know, in the onset never really gets accomplished. So partnerships, I think, with, you know, the private citizens, if you will, or consultants or attorneys or accountants or folks that do great work and say, you know what, we want to create a program where we work with you, pay you as a contractor, but then start to incentivize as you help folks connect and even help us pre-qualify people. Because the pre-qualification process a lot of times is either done through some kind of form that people can understand or some kind of program where goals need to be met. And then because the goals need to be met, everybody may not necessarily be pre-qualified, right? And people wind up in these programs and then don't even really know how to use them. So you find yourselves that, like, I won't mention any programs because I won't throw anybody under the bus, but city-run programs where you may get a $10,000 budget to spend or you may get a $50,000 budget to spend to build your capacity, but because you don't have someone to guide you through that process. And COAC Detroit's been really good at this, right? Here lately, COAC Detroit is what Tech Town is. But for, and if you have people who aren't from the Detroit area and they don't know what Tech Town is and they're tuned in, Tech Town is a nonprofit, like arm of small business incubator. Right. They're focused on tech. They're focused on tech, but they're a small business incubator of all sorts. And then what COAC Detroit is a nonprofit incubator of all types, right? So I just think that they've done a great job of doing this kind of thing, but partnering with the subject matter experts in the community, that's a short-term fix. The long-term fix is to really intuitively build processes that meet people where they are and also educate and uplift them as they resource them, but in an intuitive way, instead of just like throwing the same things that maybe I would find in one of my Masters of Community Development textbooks. Everybody's not pursuing a master's, and quite frankly, everybody doesn't have a goal to even accomplish a master's or read that kind of material. What they want to do is whatever it is they built their business around. So let's find ways to intuitively tap into that and increase our level of ease of use as we would if we wanted them to spend money with us. Right? I think that's not the approach that's normally taken. And it's like, if we take that approach, or if you guys take that approach, right, as policymakers and policy shapers, and say, let's act as if the people we're giving money to, we actually wanted them to spend money with us. How would we design the process then? And I think it becomes a lot different. I think it becomes, oh, wow, well, yeah, we definitely want it to be easy, because if they go through any hiccups, then we don't make that sale and we go bankrupt. So if we shift our perspective, right, back to perspective shift. If we shift our perspective and say, how do we design these processes and these programs to fund these businesses in a way that we would be trying to get, like, with this mentality that we want them to pay us for this? Because if you design it that way, I think a lot of things change. I think policies shift in their language. I think processes and web service or pre-qualification processes, everything changes now, because you don't want to make it difficult for people to spend money with you, because they won't until you go out of business. So, you know, those are, I guess, my broad-based recommendations. Like I said, if you ever want to do a more detailed thing on that, I would love to help be a part of that, because I have helped write legislation. I have I've researched community benefits agreements, CBAs. I've researched a lot of different things. I've worked hand in hand. You know, So I would love to offer at least a perspective on that as a part of maybe a panel or more detailed discussion. But yeah, I think those are the basic things. Right, you need to be able to address the immediate need of the community, and right now we need to make sure right folks, right organization being matched up with the right funding opportunities.
Okay, that's all how right. You get there. You know what, and I think we do need to revisit this. So I am going to probably be bothering you again about more specifically. I think I want to explore more public-private partnerships, and can I get your closing thoughts on that topic? And, you know, then of course we're going to have, part two where, we're going to have a panel of experts, and then we can delve into how you can maximize the most out of attracting people into your communities. For example, if you're a city and, a small municipality, and you want to have more entrepreneurs, or you want to activate nonprofit organizations that are community or economic development oriented, how you can do that to make sure that, everybody's set up for success, and that you're not making creating barriers so that people are like, oh, right. forget it. You know, I was going to go to Harper Woods, but now I'll go to Ferndale instead. You know, yeah. so you want to make it easy so that everybody can, you know, be feel like agency when it comes to participation.
Right. This is the money play. So anybody who's really watching right now and they got their notepads out and they want to write some stuff down, like I want to watch this and get something valuable so I can go get some money. This is the piece of advice that's going to help you go get that chicken, okay? So let's all pull out our pens, our pencils, our pads, our phones, open okay. up the memos, right? So first things first, in this work is job security for me because I'm a consultant. I come help many nonprofits do many, many things, and the needs of my clients oftentimes dictate the complexion of my engagements. But all that said, you usually have two different kinds of organizations. Organizations that do great work and don't do a good job of telling the story, or organizations that tell great stories and don't ain't really doing work that well. Okay. And now this is the part where if you are an organization that does not do great work, or let's say you don't even do any work yet, remember, corporate partnerships are representative of this main need point. These for-profit organizations need partnerships with nonprofits because essentially what they're doing, and I want to use my language carefully, but they're investing in, I won't say buying, but they're investing in results. They don't really want to spend the time or the effort or really treat it as a core competency of theirs to do whatever it is your organization specializes in. So I keep going back to the example of feeding those in need because that's just where we're at. So I want to keep the conversation simple. So for instance, and I'll just pick ABC organization or company because I don't want to use any names, but let's say ABC company is a auto manufacturer. They don't have time to be developing an entire team of folks to go out here and address the hunger need. So their investment in your organization is investing in the results. If you say with $250,000 that you can feed 15,000 families in this 26 zip code geography over the next 12 months, then we'll make that investment in your organization. And then what you have to do now, the onus on you is to be able to communicate your value or how you are uniquely qualified to do that in a competitive way. What does that mean, Keith? That's a fancy way of saying, make sure your mission, your vision, and your value statements line up with your strategic plan and your continuous improvement strategy. Make sure your mission, your vision, and your value statements line up with your strategic plan and your continuous improvement strategy. Also, make sure if you have not already conducted a proof of concept, make sure that is the next item on your agenda. Why? Because if they're investing in a proof of concept, that is giving them the confidence in your organization, know that you're going to measure your impact both quantitatively and qualitatively, and you're going to get testimonials from key stakeholders, which is going to be what they need to convincingly communicate their partnership with you, with their shareholders, to help their stock price go up. They need to know exactly what you did and what the outcome was. So if you set out to feed 25,000 or 2,500 families and you wind up feeding 2,700 families, they want to know that. They want to know how many pounds of food, and we've all seen this in marketing materials. We delivered over 100,000 pounds of fresh produce to families in need last year alone, right? That's a data point that they've been able to measure from their activity and their partnerships. So now they can communicate that in their storytelling and now make it even more impactful, but also attractive to corporations who are looking to what? Have impact on the community, because most corporations have this unspoken issue with the community where communities mostly, I know my mom used to say, your only time you're gonna be nice to me is when I'm handing you my money, that's it. And that's how a lot of people feel about, whether we're talking about things that are connected to the auto industry, or if we're talking about banks, or if we're talking about whatever, right? Private industry, you feel like the only time they want to be nice to me is when they're trying to get money out of my pocket. So in order for them to manage that and be a good corporate citizen, corporate social responsibility or CSR, right? You want to be able to engage in partnerships with local businesses as well as nonprofits and have an impact in the community based on your partnerships, and then be able to report that back. So knowing how valuable you are as a nonprofit. Social
responsibility, because you do get some companies, like, you know, you get Quicken Loans, they have the Quicken Loans Community Investment Fund. That's a corporate social responsibility arm. Then they have also Ford has the same sort of system. But, you know, people, other companies are not necessarily having that same focus on what is the legacy I'm going to leave behind when my corporation picks up and leaves this community. Because like you said about the whole,
which is an opportunity
nice to me when I'm giving you money.
Exactly, which is an opportunity for you because of all the nonprofits. This is my last point. If you're effectively measuring and documenting, I have a whole different, I have a video I'm going to release, I think, by the end of this month. And it's going to be on delivering. So it's going to be on delivering the services, tracking your service, and then reporting out, right? Those are the three main, those are the three most important operational or administrative things that you can be doing in your nonprofit is tracking how you deliver your, and investing in how you deliver your services. Tracking them appropriately and then reporting them out to the appropriate parties, right? If you've ever got a grant or managed a grant, you know you got to report out, right? If you've ever, whatever the case, right? You've already got a report. And the reporting a lot of times is the most important piece, i.e. if you don't have that report, then you won't be getting any more funding, right? So you got to make sure that you adhere to those reporting expectations. So, but anyway, that's what's so super important. And I hope that people at least got something out of that. You know, I think what I'll do too, anybody who wants to, hey, we didn't talk about this, but because, you know, you're good people, I'll even, you know, I'll come up with something. I'll talk to you about this and I'll offer like your listeners and your viewers, like a reduced rate for starting a nonprofit or whatever the case may be.
Nice,
you know,
nice, because we'll do that for you. Folks in with questions, so I think.
Yeah, I'll do that for you. I'll do that because again, right, let's just remember really quick, rapid fire round, right, 20 seconds. What do you need when you start a nonprofit? You got to go to the federal government, then you got to go to the state, then you got to go back to the federal government. You need mission, vision, value statement. You need strategic plan. You need continuous improvement. Then on top of that, you got to figure out what licenses and certifications are required for the kind of work you're going to do and how to build that staff out. Then you got to figure out who needs to be on your board of directors and what kind of structure, what kind of governmental structure needs to govern your your board of directors and how to evaluate and support your board of directors to bring money into your organization, how to build a staff, how to build programs. You need to know all of that stuff. Now, as a consultant, I take fees and I do this for people. But, you know, I also realized, too, as I kind of wind down my practice and I'm turning myself more into an investor and a philanthropist, I want to be able to wind my practice down and help as many people as I can who ordinarily wouldn't have access to the kind of resources I can help them, you know, with. And I think one of the ways to do that is to come to platforms that are more grassroots and then offer discounted services to people who ordinarily would not really have access to them. That's just like a personal thing that I think, you know, philosophy that I think really kind of helps people. And I would have loved to have it help me before I started doing what I do, you know?
So. Right. And I think that's really why I do this podcast, because I really want folks to be able to know, you know, what power they actually have, where they can actually start, get the knowledge, talk to the experts, you know, have a genuine conversation around, you know, what kind of latent potential you have and, you know, just to be able to act on it. So,
start here, so start now.
Or yes, exactly. So somebody in the chat says, thanks, great work, proud of your work, Keith. So thank you so much for being a part of the show.
Whoever that was, thank you.
For talking politics, and you dropped a lot of knowledge and wisdom on us, sir. So thank you very much. And thank you all.
Yeah, let me know when you want to have me on again. I'll be more than happy to be on and offer anything I can for free.
You're gonna be sick
of me
in a
minute. I just appreciate you again making a space. I appreciate you making a space for people to really tap in and learn something, get something valuable. And the pandemic is all the more something that people, I think, would appreciate. So kudos to you.
All right. Well, thank you everybody who joined out there in cyberspace listening and who are watching on YouTube. So we're going to go ahead and end it. Have a good night, everybody.
Good night.
All right.
Good.
And the recording is...